So, if you haven't noticed, Dr. Worthington is not here. He's sick, so we have a mystery speaker today. Ooh. Ooh, spooky season. Steven Sanders is a man of focus, commitment, and vibes. He's more than a man, he is a symbol. A symbol of Wednesdays and what they stand for. And I can assure you, whatever stories you've heard about him have been watered down. There's nothing like him except him. He's the man back in black, the hero Criswell deserves, but not the one it needs right now. He is the Steven Sanders.
I know you're thinking, boy, Dr. Worthington's looking good today. Unfortunately, he is not, and so I'm here last second. The way to really think about this, I feel like, is if it's no good, then what do you expect? I'm the B team. And if it's really great, think of how great it would have been if the actual speaker had been here. So either way, there's no pressure at all. Now, you may remember before we spent a week all developing, and maybe we need another week to rest after all that development, that that right before the break, Dr. Brown was concluding our graduate profile talks, and she talked about professional and what it means to be professional, professionalism, and she had an interesting way of looking at that, that to be professional as a believer, at least part of that, or maybe most of that, has to do with serving the Lord, whatever our job is, and through serving the Lord, looking around at the people around us and serving them as well. The consistent command in the Bible, especially in the New Testament, is that we're to serve one another. And a lot of times we talk about servant leadership. I thought it was a great point she made. We talk about servant leadership, but a lot of times that command doesn't have the word leader in it. It just has the word servant. And so I think sometimes when we think about this thing that's written all over the school in various ways, that we are supposed to be shaped by Scripture and sent to serve. A lot of times we think, oh, well, I will serve if I'm leading something. That we think that servanthood is something that, like, the leader does, or maybe sent to serve means that that's for, like, all our students who become missionaries, which some students do, or maybe students who are going into ministry. But the Bible makes clear our command to service is a part of our relationship with Christ. And so for all of us who have a relationship with Christ, we are supposed to be sent to serve, not just some of us, but all of us. And so over the next 2 weeks, today, you know, I am filling in for Dr. Worthington. Next week, we're going to have a guest speaker from For the Nations, which is a refugee outreach ministry that we partner with our local learning and service class, and we partner with their service. And so we're going to have Cameron from their organization to talk about the work they're doing, which I'm really, really excited about. I think they do great, amazing work. But these 2 weeks, I want to just spend some time to sit and think about what it means for us to serve no matter where we're sent to. And some of us probably will be maybe sent abroad, and some of us may be sent into the church, and maybe some of us are sent into various ministries, but all of us end up somewhere, and wherever we are, because of our service to the Lord, that means we have to be aware of the people around us and serve them as well. And so the way I want to frame our thoughts about this today is I want to talk about someone who wasn't a minister. I went looking for, you know, I didn't want to talk about Paul because I think that sends a little different of a message, or maybe even Moses or David. I want to talk about Boaz. You'll remember Boaz, Ruth, and Boaz. So we're going to be in the book of Ruth. We're going to eventually be in chapter 2 here. But I want to talk about Boaz and what it looked like for him to serve the people around him, especially given that he was just a small business owner. You know, he is in charge of his field. He is a landowner, and he uses this as an opportunity to serve people who are in need around him. So if you've turned there, to give us a little bit of context, at this point in the story of Ruth, which I'm sure you're familiar with, in the story of Ruth, Naomi, who is really the main character of the book, she has come back into the promised land, but she has come back without a husband because he has died, without children because they have died. And so right at the end of chapter one, she says this thing when everybody's excited to see her. She's kind of a downer here. She says, this is chapter 1, verse 20, "Call me no longer Naomi," because Naomi means pleasant or full. "Call me Mara," which means bitter, "for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me." And this is probably shocking. It's like, can you say that? Is that okay to say? And she goes further. She says, "I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back" what? "Has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me and upon the Almighty has brought and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So she leaves full, at least in the way she thinks of it. And so if you have this canister here, it's full of grain. And we have, this is the way Naomi would have seen herself when she had left Israel initially. Now, it's a little bit ironic because the reason she left Israel initially is there was a famine. But from her standpoint, because of her husband, because of her family, she felt like she had left full. But now as she comes back, God has emptied her out. And so she feels like she is now living this empty life. And I know we've all like that at different points in time. We feel like we have an emptier life because something either hasn't worked out for us, or something's been taken away from us, or something that we really wanted just isn't going to happen. And we wonder, well, where is God in all that? And Naomi thinks she knows where God is. He's the one tipping her life over and emptying it out. And so we, as the reader here, we have the question, is she right about that? And if she is right about that, is God going to do anything about it? Like, how is God going to, if God is going to refill Naomi and make her full again, how is God going to go about that? Now, what we would like to see happen is that God shows up and, like, in some audible voice, tells Naomi, "You know what, Naomi, it's going to be okay." But we get no audible voices from God in the book of Ruth. Or we might think, well, I would really like it if God showed up and, like, she won the lottery or something. Like, there is some kind of miraculous action that happened. She, like, on her way home, she happens to notice this, like, miraculous chest. And every time she opens the chest, more money appears. And she takes the money out, and the chest closes the chest, and more money ends up in the chest. Like, that's the thing God could do. He did the thing with the, you know, the oil and the bottles, all that kind of stuff. But there are no overt miracles in the book of Ruth. And so the question is God asleep at the wheel, or is God doing things in a different sort of way that we don't see? And that's what we're going to see start to try to answer is God going to refill Naomi? And if he is going to refill Naomi, how is he going to go about doing that? That's the question we're trying to answer as we go to chapter 2. And we get two hints at the very end. The last sentence of chapter 1 says, "They came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest." So the harvest has started, and they came back to Bethlehem. And for all of Naomi saying, "I came back empty, I have been away, I am bitter," it's her and Ruth. And so God is going to use these materials to start to work to refill Naomi's life. So we're going to pick up in chapter 2. I'm going to read the first three verses. "Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's side, a prominent rich man." Rich men really make the world go round, don't they? "A prominent rich man of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabite, said to Naomi, 'Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain behind someone in whose sight I may find favor.' She said to her, 'Go, my daughter.' So she went, and she came and gleaned in the field behind the reapers. As it happened, she came to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was who was of the family of Elimelech. Okay, so they've come home, as Naomi says, they're empty. Ruth says, well, we need something to eat. And so Ruth's plan to try to sustain her life, sustain Naomi's life, is she's going to go to a field and she's going to glean. Now, in ancient Israel, in the law, there were some provisions that provided something of a social safety net for the poor people of Israel. And one of the main mechanisms by which God was providing for the poor in Israel is that there were some laws about how rich people and landowners, how they would harvest their land. There were certain things that they could not do, and God had made these laws so that poor people could come and they would be able to sustain themselves. Rich people couldn't just keep everything for themselves in ancient Israel, which is different than all the other ancient civilizations around them. And so one of the main mechanisms for this was what was called gleaning. So if you went to a field in ancient Israel, when the servants or whoever is harvesting the field, they were not allowed to harvest the edges or the corners of the field. The very edges and the very corners of the field, they would be left ripe so that the poor people could come and they could take food from the edges or the corner. They couldn't go well into the field, but along the edges, they would be able to pick grain and have a little bit to eat. Now, when harvest time came, when the servants go out to harvest, if anything ever drops on the ground, the servants weren't allowed to bend over and pick up the things that had fallen on the ground. The poor people could come in after the harvesters went through, and they would be able to then pick up anything that had fallen on the ground. This was a way of kind of saying that it was providential that this fell on the ground. This is God providing for poor people. You can't take every last thing. If something drops on the ground, this is not like the 5-second rule or whatever, but the poor people can come and they can take up food from there. And the other provision was that you weren't supposed to just keep sending the harvesters through the field time and time again to strip everything down. They get to pass through. Everything that falls is for the poor, and everything that is left behind, the poor can have as well. And so it's almost as if you had the ability to go and take for yourself, legally, take for yourself a little bit of grain, and you would be able to maybe eke out a living, maybe scrape by as long as the harvest was good. And so Ruth, the plan for Ruth is, one day she's going to go through, the next day she'll go through again, she'll get a little bit probably just for that day, and every day, at least during the harvest, she's going to go through, and ideally she and Naomi, they're not going to have a lot, she's not going to be filled up, but they'll have enough to eat on. And again, this is a provision in the law, a type of social safety net for God to provide for all of his people, even for the poor people. So this is Ruth's plan. And then you also see here, I think this translation is pretty good, in verse 3, where it says, as it happened, she came to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. It's not like she got down on her knees on the way there and said, please, Lord, just let me please get to the right place. And God said to her, like, take a right. Just take a right down here. Just third house down, that field, that's the guy right there. No, it's she went out trying to serve Naomi and serve herself to glean in the field, and she just so happened to come upon the field of Naomi. I feel like a lot of times in our religious tradition, we're always like looking for signs. We want God to like make things clear to us, just to tell us what we're supposed to do or what we're not supposed to do. We're not going to like go out until God has made really clear beforehand what he's going to do. Now, God sometimes in the Bible, he works like that. But oftentimes the way God works, most of the time the way God works, is not through overt miracles or just telling people what to do. He works through providence. God can work through miracles, meaning God can break the laws of nature if he wants. He does that sometimes. But the way he normally works, and it's normal because if he's always breaking the laws of nature, they're not really laws of nature, are they? The way he normally works is he is also powerful enough to work through the laws of nature and work through human choices and work providentially. And so the first thing that we observe here about the way God fills Naomi back up is he doesn't do it overtly. He's doing it through the work of Ruth, and then he works through Ruth to send her, without even her knowledge, to the field of Boaz. And so once she gets to the field of Boaz, then we're going to see Boaz actually enter the scene here. So we're going to read verses 4 through 7. Just then Boaz came from Bethlehem. He said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." They answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "To whom does this young woman belong?" The young man who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the reapers.' So she came, and she has been on her feet from early this morning until now, without resting even for a moment." And so we notice two things. Anytime there's a story being told and a character walks in onto the stage for the first time, like, your first impression of them is really, really important. What's the first impression we have of Boaz here? What is the first thing Boaz says in the book of Ruth? His first words, what does he say here? Yeah, "The Lord be with you." And you see the workers know to respond, "And the Lord be also with you." We see immediately on his lips this idea that his relationship with the Lord is really important with us, really important to him. That Boaz has a relationship with God that he talks about. He talks about it with his coworkers. He brings it to his work, like he's not going to go very long really without mentioning his relationship with God. But notice, what is the second thing he does? What's the second thing he says? He asks, "Who is this young woman over here? I haven't noticed her before." Now, a lot of times when Ruth gets told, it gets told like some kind of love story. Ruth has been out in the field just trying to make it by for hours on end. This is not Boaz saying, "Who is that over there?" You know, this is more like, "I haven't seen her before. Who is that? Have we hired somebody new, or is she new to town? Who is this person?" Notice he's attentive to people around him. Nothing gets by him. And so you have someone on the one hand where their relationship with the Lord is really important to them, but on the other hand, they are really attentive to the people around them and what's going on. The servant can tell Boaz about Ruth's plight, and Boaz doesn't act surprised like he hasn't heard this story. Boaz is keeping up with what's happening around him. And I feel like a lot of times it can become with people kind of an either or. On the one hand, you can have people who really have this vibrant and great relationship with the Lord. Maybe they'll even tell you about it. But on the other hand, they pay no attention to the people around them. But Boaz isn't one of those people. His relationship with the Lord leads him to being incredibly attentive to the misfortune of others, the situations that other people are facing, to have some amount of compassion and see their situation. And this is going to define Boaz as a person throughout the rest of the story. And every choice he makes on some level is a reflection of his service to the Lord because of his relationship to the Lord, but also his service to, yes, Ruth, but also Naomi, and maybe even more so, Naomi through Ruth, because, again, of his relationship with the Lord. He sees this connection between his vertical relationship and his horizontal relationship. He's not some kind of priest. He doesn't work in the tabernacle. He isn't like an overtly religious person by occupation. He isn't even actually sent anywhere. He's just showing up to work today. He is the owner of the field. He's literally just going to his own property. But he's also always attentive to the people around him because he is in tune with the heart of the Lord. And so we're going to see his first interaction here with Ruth, moving on to verse 8. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Keep your eyes on the field that is being reaped and follow behind them. I have ordered the men not to bother you. If you get thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn." Then she fell prostrate with her face to the ground and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me when I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. How you left your father and mother, your native land, and came to your people, to a people that you did not know before. May the Lord reward you for your deeds, and may you have a full reward from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." Then she said, "May I continue to find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, even though I am not one of your servants." And that last part is important. She's not one of his servants. He is obligated to allow her to go after his servants and pick up what she might glean. He is not obligated to give her overarching protection. He's not obligated to go to his servants and say, "Do not run her off." He's not obligated to go to his servants and say, "Allow her to drink the water that I have paid for, I have drawn for my own employees, for my own servants." And so he tells her, "Listen, you can work, and this is what, you know, I'm responsible to provide you based on the law. But if you do that, you're never really, you know, you're always going to be just scraping by. Why don't I give you more than I am required to give you? Why don't I interject myself and go beyond what the call of duty is according to the law?" And so Boaz, this is the kind of person he is. He's like, "Well, we could do that. That's going to take all day. Why don't you actually just there? Why don't you, you know, why don't you take the water that will help you to work longer that I can provide you? And why don't you be like right behind, almost just like a step behind my servants? That way you'll be the first one to go and get any grain that possibly falls. I'll make sure that nobody mistreats you. It'd be really embarrassing if one of my reapers mistook you because you're so close to my workers and started to try to run you off because you're out of bounds. Why don't I just go ahead and make sure so that doesn't happen? That'd be embarrassing for you. Let's make sure that doesn't happen." And all of a sudden, Boaz, he's the kind of person that realizes what he has to do, what his duty is. And then he always also sees there is something he can do that is even more. And he goes beyond the call of duty. Instead of using the spoon, he uses the scoop. And he puts her in a situation where all of a sudden she can do a lot more than just scrape by for the day. Now she asks him, why is it that you are doing this for me? Why have I found favor in your sight? And what he says is that he has heard her story. And then look at verse 12. "May the Lord reward you for your deeds. May you have a full reward from the Lord." He's connecting again his actions to his relationship with God, and he sees in her someone who is like-minded, and so he wants to partner with her because of his relationship with God. Now, a person might read this story who doesn't have a relationship with the Lord, and they might say, wait, Stephen, are you telling me that the way that God is filling Naomi up, the way he is working through the situation, is to fill her up by allowing Ruth to do more than is legally like required for her to do? Isn't that just really Boaz filling Ruth up rather than God filling Ruth up? Like, who is actually at work here? Because it doesn't look like God's at work here. It just looks like Boaz is just a really nice guy. And the reality is, the answer to that is yes, both. That the way that God normally refills people, the way God normally works in this world, is through providential circumstances and through people who become the hands and feet of who God is. That Boaz has the same concern and the same character that God has, and so Boaz and Ruth as well end up representing God to Naomi. And it's through Boaz's choices that God is refilling Naomi. We go on to verse 14. "At mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come here and eat some of this bread and dip your morsel in the sour wine.' So she sat beside the reapers, and he heaped up for her some parched grain. She ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. So he's giving her a company lunch now, because it would be a shame, you know, for her to have gotten like three grains of barley, and then she has to eat one of the grains for lunch. Like, no, that's yours. Why don't you take some of the you know, the company, the catered lunch I have here for all of my workers? That way you can keep what is yours over here. Then, verse 15, when she got up to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, you know what, let her glean even among the standing sheaves, and do not reproach her. You must also pull out some handfuls for her from the bundles and leave them for her to glean, and do not rebuke her. So she gleaned until in the field until evening, and then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And so we get into a situation here where a normal person, a non-Boaz person, might say, well, look at what I've done here. Man, I am a good person. I have like cared for the, no. Lunchtime comes, he's like, well, you know what? I can do more. Here, make sure, have you tasted the sandwiches here? They are amazing. They're great. Also, listen, why don't you just rest here in the shade, really regain your strength? And you know what? I said earlier you need to be a little bit behind all of my employees. Why don't you just go through with my employees? You're not one of my employees, because what my employees take in, that goes to me. What you take in goes to you. So you're not one of my employees. But you know what? Why don't you end up just going through and getting all that you possibly can? He's just relentless. Over and over again, he chooses to go beyond the call of duty. He looks at the situation. He's attentive to the situation. He thinks about not what he has to do, but what he can do. And he finds different ways to make it so that she doesn't get just a little spoonful of barley for the day. She goes through and gets a full scoop and is able to take that home. Now, afterwards, what she does is she goes and she beats out the barley. So the barley is going to be in husk, almost looking kind of like corn. And what they would do to get the grain out of the barley is they take these big sticks and they just whack it until all of the grain fell out. Now, this is what Ruth is doing here. One time I heard this sermon, and this guy, it was almost like, it was very off-putting to me. He kept calling her like Little Ruth or something like that. Ruth was not little. Ruth was probably in better shape than any of us. You go out a few days and you just start in the heat of the day beating a bunch of grains of barley with a stick over and over again. Like, Ruth's probably pretty jacked, you know? And so she ends up, though, after beating this through, she ends up with an ephah of barley. Now, we have no idea what an ephah is. We have barely any idea what a liter is. An ephah of barley, it depends on there are different estimates for this. The low end for what Old Testament scholars believe an ephah was for barley at this time would be 30 pounds of barley. The other estimate, this is the argument Old Testament scholars have, you can ask Dr. Worsler about it, I guess, is it could be 50 pounds of barley. This is not with the husk on, this is after she has beaten it out. A normal worker for that day, just a normal, like one of the reapers, a good day, they would end up having basically a 30th of that. They would have about a pound or so. And so she ends up with basically a month's worth of barley in one day because Boaz has intersected her situation. And all of a sudden there is hope, because not they're just making it through this day. What will happen tomorrow? They make it through tomorrow, but then the harvest ends and we have to wait for the next harvest. Now, all of a sudden, they have built up this supply and they may be able to make it through for a year, for several years, if she keeps working at this rate. Verse 18, she picked it up, her 30 pounds or 50 pounds of barley, and came into town. Again, not little Ruth. Ruth is working hard here. Like, you lug 50 pounds, you know, from a field down to your house of barley. And her mother-in-law saw how much she had gleaned. Yes, I would think she would. Then she took out and gave her what was left over after she had herself had been satisfied. So what happened here is, so Ruth, like, lugging all in, this is like trivial. Ruth is lugging all of her barley. She gets in the front door, puts it down. Naomi's like, don't see this every day. And then Ruth like reaches into her back pocket and is like, we had a little bit of leftovers from the lunch. Would you like the rest of my sandwich here? So Naomi says in verse 19, her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today and where have you worked? Blessed is the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked, saying, and I liked how she says this. She's going to like, it's almost like a mystery story. The name's at the end. The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz. And then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, blessed be he by the Lord, whose kindness, we're going to come back to that, has not forsaken the living or the dead. Naomi also said to her, the man is a relative of ours, one of our nearest kin. And so what does Naomi say about Boaz? And remember, this is the Naomi that the last time we heard her speak was talking about how bitter she was because God had emptied her out. She says, blessed be he by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Here's the question. Is whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead? Is that the kindness grammatically here of the Lord, or is that the kindness of Boaz? Because it's ambiguous in the way the text is saying it here. We're not sure. Is she talking about the kindness of Boaz or the kindness of Lord and of the Lord? And that's the point. The Hebrew word here is hesed. You hear hesed a lot. Hesed comes up all over the place, usually in the Psalms. This is the word that gets translated God's loving kindness. His loving kindness, his loyal compassion, his loyal love endures forever. It's used all over the place, well over 100 times in the Old Testament, almost always of God. But here it's possibly being used of Boaz. Why? Because Boaz is a man of hesed. He goes beyond the call of duty. He gives more than duty calls for. And he does that just as the Lord does. And so it's as if the Lord has not forgotten the living or the dead, Naomi or her deceased husband, because the Lord has cared for her. How has the Lord cared for her? Through a man of hesed who has the character who is like the Lord. And also through a woman of hesed in Ruth, who has clung to her when she had no obligation as well. The way God normally works in this world is through men and women who model the relationship they have with him, the hesed, the loving kindness he gives to us in our relationships with other people. And so we're sent to serve not because we have a certain job or a certain role. We're sent to serve because wherever we are, there are things happening in the world that God is concerned with. And the question is, how do we be true professionals in the Christian sense, as Dr. Brown talked about? How do we become more attentive and more proactive in serving the Lord by representing him with hesed, with loving kindness, going beyond what our responsibilities are in our relationships with people around us? And I think we really have to do two things. We talked about this in our ministry leadership class yesterday. I think on the one hand, we have to have a little more margin in our lives. We can't always just be kind of scraping by all the time or so obsessed with our own life and the things that we're doing that we don't have attention to what is happening with everybody else. We can't be the main character for ourselves all the time in our story. We have to see the people around us, not just we have this great relationship with the Lord, but who is that person over there who I have not met? Not my best friend. I obviously know who my best friend is, but who is this person that I'm not used to seeing them around campus, or I'm not used to seeing them in my workplace, or I'm not used to seeing them in my church? Who is this that's, you know, working at my office building and cleaning up after everybody? Who is the person who is the administrative assistant? Because how you treat the administrative assistant says a lot more about your relationship with the Lord than how you treat your boss. How you treat your boss benefits you. How you treat the administrative assistant will reveal whether you are a person of hesed or not. And if you know the Lord well, you become a person of hesed. And the other thing that we have to do is we have to become more proactive. I'm sure everybody who heard Ruth and Naomi's story, their heart went out to Ruth and Naomi. Boaz's heart went out to Ruth and Naomi. his wallet also went out to Ruth and Naomi. Now, you may say, well, Steve and I don't have a lot of money. We all have a little bit of money. And how you handle a little bit of money, even as a college student, I can say this, like, I have a lot of money now, not because of me, because I married rich, which is a pro tip there. But there was a time where I had a little bit of money. And how we handled a little bit of money ended up saying a lot about how we would handle if we had a lot of money. But we also have other resources. What I have right now is not a little bit of money. I have a little bit of time. And how I use my little bit of time. Do I make time for people who are struggling? Do I notice people around me who are struggling? Am I willing to go and spend time with students that has nothing to do with my education, educating them? Nothing to do with my actual responsibilities as a professor? That says a lot about whether I actually value the people around me or not. See, one of the things that I really like about this place is I feel like we do have people of Hesed. Like, there are situations that I see go on this campus all the time. I'm not really going to talk about, like, what all I see, but there is a situation right now that Dr. Moore and Dr. Spring have walked into lately, and they've done a great job going well beyond the call of duty. I've seen the same thing at different times with Dr. Kieser, with Dr. Brown. I've seen the same things with Dr. Worsler, with Dr. Worthington. Dr. Worthington can't get gas without interjecting himself in someone else's situation. He can't. But I also see that with you guys as well. I've seen that. I've gone to lunch this semester with Will Norris. His compassion for the students he's teaching this semester goes well beyond what a school teacher should do. I've seen this with Robert Howell before. I've seen this in my class last semester with Abby Barth, with Arlie Suarez, with Anya, with the way they handled their teenage girls that they're ministering to. How do we become more like these people? Because we're in an environment where we can see these models. How do we open up more margin so that we can see the things that are happening around us? And how do we become more proactive to act on our impulses? Not just our heart goes out, but we act on our heart going out in some way. Ultimately, we are sent to serve. That's why we're bringing in For the Nations. For the Nations is modeling this for us. That's why we want to partner with them in this. Boaz partners with Ruth. How can we partner with the people who are actually the hands and feet of Jesus and God in this world and become people of Hesed? Because if we're sent to serve, what that means is we have to do more than whatever the minimum required of us is. We have to see needs around us, and we need to interject ourselves in ways, not just doing the minimum of what we have to do as a Christian, but asking ourselves, what is the most we can do, and can we use the scoop to fill up the world around us with God's love? Let's close in prayer. Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for all the ways you have provided for us, sometimes miraculously, sometimes overtly, but also oftentimes through the Hesed of people around us, the men and women who represent you in our own lives. And I pray, God, that you would help each of us to find ways to create more margin and headspace in our lives to notice not just our own difficulties, but also the different things that are happening in the lives of people that they're struggling with. Maybe across our hall, maybe in our classes, maybe at our jobs, maybe in our families, and find ways to be proactive to show your love to the world that needs it around us. It's in Jesus' name that I pray. Amen.
Okay, let's say thank you to Dr. Sanders. It is supposed to be. There we go. Now we got it. Okay, as a reminder, I have Discord up if you have questions for Dr. Sanders or another member of our panel. And while I give you a chance to do that, I see typing. Very exciting. So Dr. Sanders, I appreciate this more than I can say. I leaned over to Dr. Brown because the only version of the story that I have ever heard is the dating version. Because I did a Bible study in high school called Lady in Waiting.
So yeah, you did.
Yes. Subtitle, How to Get a Boaz, Not a Bozo.
To be fair, I think you really want a Boaz, not a Bozo.
Yes, but it was...
How did that work for you?
I did not marry rich. Let's just say that. Like, did not do the pro tip. So. No. And my only hope is, I guess, to become the rich man. To marry myself. But anyway, sorry. But no, so how did you come up with Boaz as an example so that we can sort of see the story in a different way?
Yeah, I think that I think a lot of it is just really paying attention to the words that are being used on the text. I think a lot of times we'll go into stories, we talk about this in hermeneutics, and we think we already know what the plot line is, and we put our own plot onto something. A man and a woman end up meeting and marrying. Like, we've seen that movie, right? So it must be like a meet cute, not an actual, like, I'm checking into what your actual situation is as a, you know, a distant relative here. And what we see in the story is this emphasis in chapter one, not on Ruth or Boaz, but on Naomi and her plight. And this is the question that gets asked over and over again. And so as the reader, the question becomes, well, how is God actually going to work this out, especially in a situation where he doesn't overtly do any miracles? And what we see is, even in chapter three makes no sense, the fact they aren't married by the end of chapter three, other than Boaz is again going out and trying to benefit not just Ruth, but also Naomi. And at the end of the story, we see Naomi with the child as this answer to God fulfilling her, not Ruth or not Boaz. And so I think a lot of times it's just reading people's situations without pre-deciding what the story must be, but actually listening to what's happening. That's true either of the text or of, like, the people we're around as well.
Well, actually, so one of the first questions is actually, is there another way to see the story where that isn't this just family bias and him giving preferential treatment to Ruth and not the other poor people in the field?
Yeah, well, first of all, Ruth's not his family at this point, just legally. Her husband had deceased, and her... you know, she, as Naomi rightfully said, she had no obligation, just like Orpah had no obligation to follow Naomi back. So Ruth isn't technically even, I know Boaz treats her as that way, but that's Boaz going beyond the call of duty, not the actual, you know, she was family by marriage, but that marriage has ended. And by their law, he had no responsibility necessarily to her. Honestly, even the gleaning is a little bit questionable just because she's not an Israelite. She's from Moab. But I think the other thing is, I think that ultimately we also see how Boaz treats everybody else as well. It would be one thing if Boaz was clearly showing preferential treatment, but even the way he's treating his workers. Now, again, you have to pay attention. It's subtle, but the way he's treating his workers is he's providing lunch for them. He's providing shade for them. He's providing water for them. And I think one thing that really has stuck out to me the last few times I think I've read it, because we always read things in a certain context for ourselves, is there's always this, like, political back and forth in America about, like, social safety net and what people should provide and what's the role of the church. And notice he's not super angsty about what he has to provide or what he needs to provide. He just does the right thing, you know, over and over again, not just to Ruth and not just to Naomi, but his workers as well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Question for the panel then, speaking of that, because Boaz is obviously in a position to do so, but this next question actually says, and we are all on the stage kind of in positions of authority, but do you remember a time when you were younger and still able to do this? Or so how do we do this not in those positions of authority?
Yeah, I've got some examples. One that comes to mind was back when I was in college. I was in a bit better shape than I am now. Yeah, you can't believe that. I used to look something like this guy. But I didn't have much money at all. For me, it was, I think, just using the capabilities that God had given me to serve others. One of the things I somewhat took pride in was anytime somebody's car broke down on the road and they were stuck in the roadway, I would come up behind them, jump out, tell them to get in their car, and I would literally push their car, oftentimes slightly uphill, and get them out of the roadway to help them out. Well, then there was an opportunity then to share God's grace to me with those individuals that I was ministering to in that capacity. So it goes beyond just being wealthy. What are you capable of individually in your own circumstance ministering where you are to those individuals so that you come into contact with? Which is what I loved about you, the way you presented this, is because oftentimes those happenstance moments are providential. Mm-hmm. And so we ought to take advantage of those because it's in those moments that God is at work. So take the opportunity to use those to further God's word.
And so then another question then is, so how do you balance that, though, with making sure that we ourselves are kind of fed and rested and able to continue doing mm-hmm. that? So how do we not keep giving until we don't have anything left?
Yeah, I'll speak to that for a second. One of the things I really like about the Gospel of Luke is that, and I know Dr. Worthington has talked about this in chapel before, is that the story that immediately follows the parable of the Good Samaritan is Mary and Martha, and Mary sitting at Jesus' feet and listening to him. And so it's not an either or. This is an important thing with Boaz. Boaz, he isn't there early in the morning, you know? Like, she's already been working hours before he even shows up here. And he also, like, he is living his life and fits her, has enough margin to fit her in, rather than he has no margins whatsoever. And I think that a lot of it is, are we serving people out of our own strength to make ourselves look better in front of others or to God, to like pay God back in some way? Or is it like Mary, we have sat at the feet of Jesus and listened to him, and then from that, though, we don't just keep it to ourselves, we work it out in our lives and in the situations around us as well. There has to be both and, not either or.
Anything to add, Dr. Brown?
I just keep thinking about if Dr. Moore were here.
Boundaries. I feel like she would say boundaries are essential.
She'd also say resurrection.
And Mark, Gospel of Mark. Yeah, in fact, actually, I believe she's actually preaching on Mark at DTS Chapel right now.
And boundaries.
But it is. If we're going to have margin in our lives, then one of the things you get to practice is saying the word no. That's a good thing, but that's not the best thing. And so I'm going to carve out some boundaries so that I do have some margin, that when the really great things present themselves, I have the time and the energy and the effort to be able to do that. And I'm not so exhausted or so depleted that I have to say, I'm going to have to say no to that too.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's important there is, what are you saying no to, and what are your boundaries? Because we all have boundaries somewhere. We're limited, we're human. Mm-hmm. But are we going to set boundaries on what we're watching on Netflix? Or are we going to set boundaries on hanging out with my best friend all the time? Or am I going to set, you know, my boyfriend or my girlfriend, am I going to set boundaries on, well, I always get this coffee, and therefore I don't have quite as much money to give. I'm mm-hmm. not rich. You know, it's what are you setting your boundaries on? Boaz was setting his boundaries on himself on some level, or
his profit margin, so that he would then have something to give. So I think it's also, where are you setting your boundaries?
Well, and I do think, like, obviously, Dr. Corder's example is, I mean, that's a very physical, like, time-consuming example.
It's what Ruth would do. Yeah. Push that car up that hill.
Yes, be jacked like Ruth and Dr. Corder.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I do think some of what you're talking about is just to, if you feel the prompting of the Spirit, it can be a text that says, I'm praying for you, mm-hmm. and then, but that reaches out.
Or even better, just actually praying for the person.
What?
Yeah.
I can't just say it? That's not mm-hmm. very Baptist, no. Right? I'm just, mm-hmm. can't I just say that we have a prayer request?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No. There you go. Okay. Unspoken,
yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I like that. So, and then not telling them at all, just praying for them in that
Well,
moment.
You could do that. You could also text, but just make sure you pray if you text.
Okay. Yeah, but mm-hmm. I just want to point, and I think each of you are making this point, that it can be sort of anything. There's a scale here. And again, sort of praying, right, God, what opportunities do you have for me today? Mm-hmm. So, okay. I know before, as we begin to wrap up, mm-hmm. then you have an announcement.
I have an announcement. So some of you longtime Wednesday goers may remember a certain Wednesday last year, and a certain friend of us all, T-Dog, or as you know her, Dr. T-Dog, Dr. T-Dog was turning 50, and so we had Dr. T-Dog's end of 40s costume party, and we gave chapel credit for it on a Wednesday. It was also became famous because there was a fire, but it wasn't really a fire. I set off a smoke machine that set off the fire alarm, and we had to empty the building. It was a Wednesday miracle. No haze, no praise. This is my reminder that actually Dr. Moore is going to turn 50 again this year. And so we're going to have the second annual Dr. T-Dog's End of 40s Halloween costume party. It's going to be from 11 to noon next Wednesday. Now, you might say I have class beforehand. A real Wednesday goer would go to class in costume. But from 11 to 12, you also get chapel credit if you attend. Second annual Dr. T-Dog's End of 40s Halloween costume party bash. I don't know what it says up there. Guys, it's going to be lit. And we will see
but
you.
No haze.
No haze, no praise.
That is now Dr. Sanders' boundary moving forward is no more smoke machines.
Yeah, we'll have to do something different. We will see you at said Halloween costume party in 6 hours, or 6 days and 23 hours. You're dismissed.